party, like a rainy picnic to which only the dullest bores had come, like a humdrum exercise, like a bit of dry mud caking her childhood. I just managed to jerk my knee out of the range of a sketchy tap, one of her acquired gestures. She asked me not to be dense. The past was the past. I had been a good father, she guessed, granting me that. Proceed, Dolly Schiller. Well, did I know that he had known her mother? That he was practically an old friend? That he had visited with his uncle in Ramsdale, oh, years ago, and spoken at Mother's Club, and had tugged and pulled her, Dolly, by her bare arm onto his lap in front of everybody, and kissed her face, she was 10, and furious with him? Did I know he had seen me and her at the inn where he was writing the very play she was to rehearse in Beardsley 2 years later? Did I know? It had been horrid of her to sidetrack me into believing that Claire was an old female, maybe a relative of his, or a sometime life-mate. And, oh, what a close shave it had been when the Waste Journal carried his picture. The Bryceland Gazette had not. Yes, very amusing. Yes, she said, this world was just one gag after another. If somebody wrote up her life, nobody would ever believe it. At this point there came brisk, homey sounds from the kitchen into which Dick and Bill had lumbered in quest of beer. Through the doorway they noticed the visitor, and Dick entered the parlour. "Dick, this is my dad!" cried Dolly in a resounding, violent voice that struck me as totally strange, and new and cheerful and old and sad, because the young fellow, veteran of a remote war, was hard of hearing. Arctic blue eyes, black hair, ruddy cheeks, unshaven chin. We shook hands. Discreet Bill, who evidently took pride in working wonders with one hand, brought in the beer cans he had opened, wanted to withdraw. The exquisite courtesy of simple folks was made to stay. A beer ad. In point of fact, I preferred it that way, and so did the Schillers. I switched to the jittery rocker. Avidly munching, Dolly plied me with marshmallows and potato chips. The men looked at her fragile, frilieu, diminutive, old-world, youngish but sickly father in velvet coat and beige vest, maybe a viscount. They were under the impression I had come to stay, and Dick, with a great wrinkling of brows that denoted difficult thought, suggested Dolly and he might sleep in the kitchen on a spare mattress. I waved a light hand and told Dolly, who transmitted it by means of a special shout to Dick, that I had merely dropped in on my way to Reedsburg, where I was to be entertained by some friends and admirers. It was then noticed that one of the few thumbs remaining to Bill was bleeding. Not such a wonder-worker after all. How womanish and somehow never seen that way before was the shadowy division between her pale breasts when she bent down over the man's hand. She took him for repairs to the kitchen. For a few minutes, three or four little eternities which positively welled with artificial warmth, Dick and I remained alone. He sat on a hard chair, rubbing his forelimbs and frowning. I had an idle urge to squeeze out the blackheads on the wings of his perspiring nose with my long agate claws. He had nice, sad eyes with beautiful lashes and very white teeth. His Adam's apple was large and hairy. Why don't they shave better, these young brawny chaps? He and his Dolly had had unrestrained intercourse on that couch there at least 180 times, probably much more. And before that, how long had she known him? No grudge, funny, no grudge at all. Nothing except grief and nausea. He was now rubbing his nose. I was sure that when finally he would open his mouth, he would say, slightly shaking his head, "Oh, she's a swell kid, Mr. Hayes, she sure is, and she's going to make a swell mother." He opened his mouth and took a sip of beer. This gave him countenance, and he went on sipping till he frothed at the mouth. He was a lamb. He had cupped her Florentine breasts. His fingernails were black and broken, but the phalanges, the whole carpus, the strong, shapely wrist were far, far finer than mine. I have hurt too much, too many bodies with my twisted poor hands to be proud of them. French epithets are Dorset yokel's knuckles and Austrian tailor's flat fingertips. That's Humbert Humbert. Good. If he was silent, I could be silent too. Indeed, I could very well do with a little rest in this subdued, frightened-to-death rocking chair before I drove to wherever the beast's lair was, and then pulled the pistol's foreskin back, and then enjoyed the orgasm of the crushed trigger. I was always a good little follower of the Viennese medicine man. But presently I became sorry for poor Dick, whom, in some hypnotoid way, I was horribly preventing from making the only remark he could think up. She's a swell kid. And so I said, "Are you going to Canada?" In the kitchen, Dolly was laughing at something Bill had said or done. "And so," I shouted, "you are going to Canada?" "Not Canada," I re-shouted. "I mean Alaska, of course." He nursed his glass and, nodding sagely, replied, "Well, he caught it on a jagger, I guess. Lost his right arm in Italy." Lovely mauve almond trees in bloom. A blown-off surrealistic arm hanging up there in the pointillistic mauve. A flower girl tattoo on the hand. Dolly and band-aided Bill reappeared. It occurred to me that her ambiguous brown and pale beauty excited the cripple. Dick, with a grin of relief, stood up. He guessed Bill and he would be going back to fix those wires. He guessed Mr. Hayes and Dolly had loads of things to say to each other. He guessed he would be seeing me before I left. Why do these people guess so much and shave so little and are so disdainful of hearing aids? "Sit down," she said, audibly striking her flanks with her palms. I relapsed into the black rocker. "So, you betrayed me. Where did you go? Where is he now?" She took from the mantelpiece a concave, glossy snapshot. Old woman in white, stout, beaming, bow-legged, very short dress. Old man in his shirt-sleeves, drooping moustache, watch-chain. Her in-laws. Living with Dick's brother's family in Juneau. "Sure you don't want to smoke?" She was smoking herself. First time I saw her doing it. Streng verboten under Humbert the Terrible. Gracefully, in blue mist, Charlotte Hayes rose from her grave. I would find him through Uncle Ivory if she refused.
"Betrayed you? No."
She directed the dart of her cigarette, index rapidly tapping upon it, toward the hearth, exactly as her mother used to do. And then, like her mother, oh my God, with her fingernail scratched and removed a fragment of cigarette paper from her underlip. No, she had not betrayed me. I was among friends. A deucer had warned her that Q liked little girls, had been almost jailed once, in fact, nice fact, and he knew she knew. Yes, elbow in palm, puff, smile, exhaled smoke, darting gesture, waxing reminiscent. He saw, smiling, through everything and everybody, because he was not like me and her, but a genius, a great guy, full of fun, had rocked with laughter when she confessed about me and her, and said he'd thought so. It was quite safe under the circumstances to tell him. Well, Q, they all called him Q. Her camp 5 years ago, curious coincidence, took her to a dude ranch about a day's drive from Elephant, Elphinstone, named, oh, some silly name, Duk Duk Ranch. You know, just plain silly. But it didn't matter now, anyway, because the place had vanished and disintegrated. Really, she meant, I could not imagine how utterly lush that ranch was. She meant it had everything, but everything, even an indoor waterfall. Did I remember the red-haired guy we was good, had once had some tennis with? Well, the place really belonged to Red's brother, but he turned it over to Q for the summer. When Q and she came, the others had them actually go through a coronation ceremony, and then a terrific ducking, as when you cross the equator, you know. Her eyes rolled in synthetic resignation. Go on, please. Well, the idea was he would take her in September to Hollywood and arrange a tryout for her, a bit part in the tennis match scene of a movie picture based on a play of his, Golden Guts, and perhaps even have her double one of his sensational starlets on the Klieg-struck tennis court. Alas, it never came to that. Where is the hog now? He was not a hog. He was a great guy in many respects. But it was all drink and drugs, and of course he was a complete freak in sex matters, and his friends were his slaves. I just could not imagine. I, Humbert, could not imagine what they all did at Duk Duk Ranch. She refused to take part because she loved him, and he threw her out. What things?
Oh, weird, filthy, fancy things. I mean, he had two girls and two boys and three or four men, and the idea was for all of us to tangle in nude while an old woman took movie pictures. Saad's Justine was 12 at the start.
What things, exactly?
Oh, things. Oh, I really... She uttered the I as a subdued cry while she listened to the source of the ache, and for lack of words spread the five fingers of her angularly up and down moving hand. No, she gave it up. She refused to go into particulars with that baby inside her.
That made sense.
It's of no importance now, she said, pounding a grey cushion with her fist and then lying back belly up on the divan. Crazy things, filthy things. I said, no, I'm just not going to. She used, in all insouciance really, a disgusting slang term which in literal French translation would be souffle, your beastly boys, because I want only you. Well, he kicked me out.
There was not much else to tell. That winter, 1949, Faye and she had found jobs. For almost 2 years she had, doing some restaurant work in small places, and then she had met Dick. No, she didn't know where the other was. In New York, she guessed. Of course, he was so famous she would have found him at once if she had wanted. Faye had tried to get back to the ranch, and it just was not there anymore. It had burned to the ground. Nothing remained, just a charred heap of rubbish. It was so strange, so strange. She closed her eyes and opened her mouth, leaning back on the cushion, one felted foot on the floor. The wooden floor slanted. A little steel ball would have rolled into the kitchen. I knew all I wanted to know. I had no intention of torturing my darling. Somewhere beyond Bill's shack, an after-work radio had begun singing of folly and fate. And there she was with her ruined looks and her adult rope-veined narrow hands and her goose-flesh white arms and her shallow ears and her unkempt armpits. There she was, my Lolita, hopelessly worn at 17, with that baby dreaming already in her of becoming a big shot and retiring around 2020 AD. And I looked and looked at her and knew as clearly as I know I am to die that I loved her more than anything I had ever seen or imagined on earth or hoped for anywhere else. She was only the faint violet whiff and dead-leaf echo of the nymphette I had rolled myself upon with such cries in the past, an echo on the brink of a russet ravine, with a far wood under a white sky and brown leaves choking the brook and one last cricket in the crisp weeds. But thank God it was not that echo alone that I worshipped. What I used to pamper among the tangled vines of my heart, mon grand péché radieux, had dwindled to its essence. Sterile and selfish vice, all that I cancelled and cursed. You may jeer at me and threaten to clear the court, but until I am gagged and half-throttled, I will shout my poor truth. I insist the world know how much I loved my Lolita, this Lolita, pale and polluted and big with another's child, but still grey-eyed, still sooty-lashed, still auburn and almond, still Carmencita, still mine. Changeons de vie, ma Carmen. Allons vivre quelque part où nous ne serons jamais séparés. Ohio, the wilds of Massachusetts. No matter, even if those eyes of hers would fade to myopic fish, and her nipples swell and crack, and her lovely young velvety delicate delta be tainted and torn, even then I would go mad with tenderness at the mere sight of your dear wan face, at the mere sound of your raucous young voice, my Lolita. Lolita, I said. This may be neither here nor there, but I have to say it. Life is very short. From here to that old car you know so well is a stretch of 20-25 paces. It is a very short walk. Make those 25 steps, now, right now, just come as you are, and we shall live happily ever after. Carmen, voulez-vous venir avec moi?
You mean, she said, opening her eyes and raising herself slightly, the snake that may strike. You mean you will give us, that money only if I go with you to a motel? Is that what you mean?
No, I said.
You got it all wrong. I want you to leave your incidental dick and this awful hole and come to live with me and die with me and everything with me, words to that effect. You're crazy, she said, her features working. Think it over, Lolita. There are no strings attached, except perhaps, well, no matter. A reprieve, I wanted to say, but did not. Anyway, if you refuse, you will still get your trousseau. No kidding, asked Dolly. I handed her an envelope with $400 in cash and a check for 3,600 more. Gingerly, uncertainly, she received mon petit cadeau, and then her forehead became a beautiful pink. You mean, she said with agonized emphasis, you were giving us $4,000? I covered my face with my hand and broke into the hottest tears I have ever shed. I felt them winding through my fingers and down my chin and burning me, and my nose got clogged, and I could not stop, and then she touched my wrist. I'll die if you touch me, I said. You're sure you're not coming with me? Is there no hope of your coming? Tell me only this. No, she said. No, honey, no. She had never called me honey before. No, she said. It is quite out of the question. I would sooner go back to Kew. I mean... She groped for words. I supplied them mentally. He broke my heart. You merely broke my life. I think, she went on. Oops. The envelope skidded to the floor. She picked it up. I think it's, oh, utterly grand of you to give us all that dough. It settles everything. We can start next week. Oh, stop crying, please. You should understand. Let me get you some more beer. Oh, don't cry. I'm so sorry I cheated so much, but that's the way things are. I wiped my face with my fingers. She smiled at the cadeau. She exulted. She wanted to call Dick. I said I would have to leave in a moment. Did not want to see him at all. We tried to think of some subject for conversation. For some reason I kept seeing, it trembled and silkily glowed on my damp retina, a radiant child of 12, sitting on a threshold, pinging pebbles on an empty can. I almost said, trying to find some casual remark, I wonder sometimes what has become of the little McCoo girl. Did she ever get better? But stopped in time, lest she rejoin, I wonder sometimes what has become of the little Hayes girl. Finally, I reverted to money matters. That sum, I said, represented more or less the net rent from her mother's house. She said, had it not been sold years ago? No, I admit, I had told her this in order to sever all connections with Ramsdale. A lawyer would send a full account of the financial situation later. It was rosy. Some of the small securities her mother had owned had gone up and up. Yes, I was quite sure I had to go. I had to go and find him and destroy him. Since I would not have survived the touch of her lips, I kept retreating in a mincing dance at every step she and her belly made toward me. She and the dog saw me off. I was surprised, this is a rhetorical figure, I was not, that the sight of the old car in which she had ridden as a child and a nymphette left her so very indifferent. All she remarked was that it was getting sort of purplish about the gills. I said it was hers, I could go by bus. She said, don't be silly, they would fly to Jupiter and buy a car there. I said I would buy this one from her for $500. At this rate, we'll be millionaires next, she said to the ecstatic dog. Comme incite, lui demande-je. One last word, I said in my horrible, careful English. Are you quite sure that... Well, not tomorrow, of course, and not after tomorrow, but, well, some day, I mean, any day, you will not come to live with me. I will create a brand new god and thank him with piercing cries if you give me that microscopic hope, to that effect. No, she said, smiling, no. It would have made all the difference, said Humbert. Then I pulled out my automatic. I mean, this is the kind of fool thing a reader might suppose I did. It never even occurred to me to do it. Goodbye, she chanted, my American, sweet, immortal, dead love. For she is dead and immortal if you are reading this. I mean, such is the formal agreement with the so-called authorities. Then, as I drove away, I heard her shout in a vibrant voice to her Dick, and the dog started to lope alongside my car like a fat dolphin, but he was too heavy and too old and very soon gave up. and presently I was driving through the drizzle of the dying day, with the windshield wipers in full action, but unable to cope with my tears. Leaving as I did Coalmont around 4 in the afternoon, by Route X, I do not remember the number, I might have made Ramsdale by dawn, had not a shortcut tempted me. I had to get onto Highway Y. My map showed quite blandly that, just beyond Woodbine, which I reached at nightfall, I could leave paved X and reach paved Y by means of a transverse dirt road. It was only some 40 miles long, according to the map. Otherwise, I would have to follow X for another 100 miles, and then use leisurely looping Z to get to Y and my destination. However, the shortcut in question got worse and worse, bumpier and bumpier, muddier and muddier, and when I attempted to turn back after some 10 miles of purblind, tortuous and tortoise-slow progress, my old and weak Melmoth got stuck in deep clay. All was dark and muggy and hopeless. My headlights hung over a broad ditch full of water. The surrounding country, if any, was a black wilderness. I sought to extricate myself, but my rear wheels only whined in slosh and anguish. Cursing my plight, I took off my fancy clothes, changed into slacks, pulled on the bullet-riddled sweater, and waded 4 miles back to a roadside farm. It started to rain on the way, but I had not the strength to go back for a mackintosh. Such incidents have convinced me that my heart is basically sound, despite recent diagnoses. Around midnight, a wrecker dragged my car out. I navigated back to Highway X and travelled on. Utter weariness overtook me an hour later in an anonymous little town. I pulled up at the curb and in darkness drank deep from a friendly flask. The rain had been cancelled miles before. It was a black, warm night somewhere in Appalachia. Now and then cars passed me, red taillights receding, white headlights advancing. But the town was dead. Nobody strolled and laughed on the sidewalks as relaxing burghers would in sweet, mellow, rotting Europe. I was alone to enjoy the innocent night and my terrible thoughts. A wire receptacle on the curb was very particular about acceptable contents. Sweepings, paper, no garbage. Sherry-red letters of light marked a camera shop. A large thermometer with the name of a laxative quietly dwelt on the front of a drugstore. Rubinoff's Jewelry Company had a display of artificial diamonds reflected in a red mirror. A lighted green clock swam in the linenish depths of Jiffy Jeff Laundry. On the other side of the street a garage said in its sleep, "Genuflection Lubricity," and corrected itself to "Gulflex Lubrication." An airplane, also gemmed by Rubinoff, passed droning in the velvety heavens. How many small dead-of-night towns I had seen. This was not yet the last. Let me dally a little. He is as good as destroyed. Some way further across the street, neon lights flickered twice slower than my heart. The outline of a restaurant sign, a large coffee pot, kept bursting every full second or two into emerald life, and every time it went out, pink letters saying "Fine Foods" relayed it, but the pot could still be made out as a latent shadow teasing the eye before its next emerald resurrection. We made shadow graphs. This furtive burg was not far from the enchanted hunters. I was weeping again, drunk on the impossible past. At this solitary stop for refreshments between Coalmont and Ramsdale, between innocent Dolly Schiller and jovial Uncle Ivor, I reviewed my case. With the utmost simplicity and clarity I now saw myself and my love. Previous attempts seemed out of focus in comparison. A couple of years before, under the guidance of an intelligent French-speaking confessor to whom, in a moment of metaphysical curiosity, I had turned over a Protestant's drab atheism for an old-fashioned popish cure, I had hoped to deduce from my sense of sin the existence of a supreme being. On those frosty mornings in rime-laced Quebec, the good priest worked on me with the finest tenderness and understanding. I am infinitely obliged to him and the great institution he represented. alas, I was unable to transcend the simple human fact that whatever spiritual solace I might find, whatever lithophanic eternities might be provided for me, nothing could make my Lolita forget the foul lust I had inflicted upon her. Unless it can be proven to me as I am now, today, with my heart and my beard and my putrefaction, that in the infinite run it does not matter a jot that a North American girl child named Dolores Hayes had been deprived of her childhood by a maniac. Unless this can be proven, and if it can, then life is a joke. I see nothing for the treatment of my misery but the melancholy and very local palliative of articulate art. To quote an old poet, "The moral sense in mortals is the duty we have to pay on mortal sense of beauty." There was the day during our first trip, our first circle of paradise, when in order to enjoy my phantasms of peace, I firmly decided to ignore what I could not help perceiving, the fact that I was to her not a boyfriend, not a glamour man, not a pal, not even a person at all, but just two eyes and a foot of engorged brawn, to mention only mentionable matters. There was the day when, having withdrawn the functional promise I had made her on the eve, whatever she had set her funny little heart on, a roller rink with some special plastic floor, or a movie matinee to which she wanted to go alone, I happened to glimpse from the bathroom, through a chance combination of mirror aslant and door ajar, a look on her face. That look I cannot exactly describe, an expression of helplessness so perfect that it seemed to grade into one of rather comfortable inanity, just because this was the very limit of injustice and frustration. And every limit presupposes something beyond it, hence the neutral illumination. And when you bear in mind that these were the raised eyebrows and parted lips of a child, you may better appreciate what depths of calculated carnality, what reflected despair, restrained me from falling at her dear feet and dissolving in human tears, and sacrificing my jealousy to whatever pleasure Lolita might hope to derive from mixing with dirty and dangerous children in an outside world that was real to her. And I have still other smothered memories, now unfolding themselves into limbless monsters of pain. Once, in a sunset-ending street of Beardsley, she turned to little Eva Rosen. I was taking both nymphets to a concert and walking behind them so close as almost to touch them with my person. She turned to Eva, and so very serenely and seriously, in answer to something the other had said about its being better to die than hear Milton Pinsky, some local schoolboy she knew, talk about music, my Lolita remarked, "You know, what's so dreadful about dying is you are completely on your own." And it struck me, as my automaton knees went up and down, that I simply did not know a thing about my darling's mind, and that quite possibly, behind the awful juvenile clichés, there was in her a garden and a twilight, and a palace gate, dim and adorable regions which happened to be lucidly and absolutely forbidden to me, in my polluted rags and miserable convulsions. For I often noticed that living as we did, she and I, in a world of total evil, we would become strangely embarrassed whenever I tried to discuss something she and an older friend, she and a parent, she and a really healthy sweetheart, I and Annabel, Lolita and a sublime, purified, analyzed, deified Harold Hayes, might have discussed. An abstract idea, a painting, stippled Hopkins or Sean Baudelaire, God or Shakespeare, anything of a genuine kind. Goodwill. She would mail her vulnerability in trite brashness and boredom, whereas I, using for my desperately detached comments an artificial tone of voice that set my own last teeth on edge, provoked my audience to such outbursts of rudeness as made any further conversation impossible. Oh, my poor bruised child. I loved you. I was a pentapot monster, but I loved you. I was despicable and brutal and turpid and everything. Mais je t'aimais, je t'aimais. And there were times when I knew how you felt, And it was hell to know it, my little one. Lolita girl, brave Dolly Schiller. I recall certain moments, let us call them icebergs in paradise, when, having had my fill of her, after fabulous, insane exertions that left me limp and azure-barred, I would gather her in my arms with, at last, a mute moan of human tenderness, her skin glistening in the neon light coming from the paved court through the slits in the blind, her soot-black lashes matted, her grave grey eyes more vacant than ever, for all the world a little patient still in the confusion of a drug after a major operation. And the tenderness would deepen to shame and despair, and I would lull and rock my lone light Lolita in my marble arms, and moan in her warm hair, and caress her at random, and mutely ask her blessing. And at the peak of this human, agonized, selfless tenderness, with my soul actually hanging around her naked body and ready to repent, all at once, ironically, horribly, lust would swell again, and, "Oh no," Lolita would say with a sigh to heaven, and the next moment the tenderness and the azure, all would be shattered. Mid-20th century ideas concerning child-parent relationship have been considerably tainted by the scholastic rigmarole and standardized symbols of the psychoanalytic racket. But I hope I am addressing myself to unbiased readers. Once, when Avis's father had honked outside to signal Papa had come to take his pet home, I felt obliged to invite him into the parlour. And he sat down for a minute, and while we conversed, Avis, a heavy, unattractive, affectionate child, drew up to him and eventually perched plumply on his knee. Now, I do not remember if I have mentioned that Lolita always had an absolutely enchanting smile for strangers, a tender, furry slitting of the eyes, a dreamy, sweet radiance of all her features, which did not mean a thing, of course, but was so beautiful, so endearing, that one found it hard to reduce such sweetness to but a magic gene, automatically lighting up her face in atavistic token of some ancient rite of welcome. Hospitable prostitution, the coarse reader may say. Well, there she stood, while Mr. Bird twirled his hat and talked, and, yes, look how stupid of me, I've left out the main characteristic of the famous Lolita smile, namely, while the tender, nectared, dimpled brightness played, it was never directed at the stranger in the room, but hung in its own remote flowered void, so to speak, or wandered with myopic softness over chance objects. And this is what was happening now. While fat Avis sidled up to her papa, Lolita gently beamed at a fruit knife that she fingered on the edge of the table, whereon she leaned, many miles away from me. Suddenly, as Avis clung to her father's neck and ear, while with a casual arm the man enveloped his lumpy and large offspring, I saw Lolita's smile lose all its light and become a frozen little shadow of itself, and the fruit knife slipped off the table and struck her with its silver handle a freak blow on the ankle which made her gasp and crouch head forward, and then, jumping on one leg, her face awful with the preparatory grimace which children hold till the tears gush, she was gone, to be followed at once and consoled in the kitchen by Avis, who had such a wonderful fat pink dad and a small chubby brother and a brand new baby sister and a home and two grinning dogs, and Lolita had nothing. And I have a neat pendant to that little scene, also in a Beardsley setting. Lolita, who had been reading near the fire, stretched herself and then inquired, her elbow up with a grunt, "Where is she buried, anyway?"
"Who?"
"Oh, you know, my murdered mummy."
"And you know where her grave is," I said, controlling myself. Whereupon I named the cemetery, just outside Ramsdale, between the railway tracks and Lakeview Hill. "Moreover," I added, "the tragedy of such an accident is somewhat cheapened by the epithet you saw fit to apply to it. If you really wish to triumph in your mind over the idea of death—"
"Ray," said Lowe, for hooray, and languidly left the room. And for a long while I stared, with smarting eyes, into the fire.
Then I picked up her book. It was some trash for young people. There was a gloomy girl, Marion, and there was her stepmother, who turned out to be, against all expectations, a young, grey, understanding redhead, who explained to Marion that Marion's dead mother had really been a heroic woman, since she had deliberately dissimulated her great love for Marion because she was dying, and did not want her child to miss her. I did not rush up to her room with cries. I always preferred the mental hygiene of non-interference. Now, squirming and pleading with my own memory, I recall that on this and similar occasions, it was always my habit and method to ignore Lolita's states of mind while comforting my own base self. When my mother, in a livid wet dress under the tumbling mist, so I vividly imagined her, had run panting ecstatically up that ridge above Moulinet to be felled there by a thunderbolt, I was but an infant, and in retrospect no yearnings of the accepted kind could I ever graft upon any moment of my youth. No matter how savagely psychotherapists heckled me in my later periods of depression. But I admit that a man of my power of imagination cannot plead personal ignorance of universal emotions. I may also have relied too much on the abnormally chill relations between Charlotte and her daughter. But the awful point of the whole argument is this. It had become gradually clear to my conventional Lolita during our singular and bestial cohabitation that even the most miserable of family lives was better than the parody of incest, which, in the long run, was the best I could offer the waif. Ramsdale revisited. I approached it from the side of the lake. The sunny noon was all eyes. As I rode by in my mud-flecked car, I could distinguish scintillas of diamond water between the far pines. I turned into the cemetery and walked among the long and short stone monuments. Bonjour, Charlotte. On some of the graves there were pale, transparent little national flags slumped in the windless air under the evergreens. Gee, Ed, that was bad luck, referring to G. Edward Grammer, a 35-year-old New York office manager who had just been arraigned on a charge of murdering his 33-year-old wife, Dorothy. Bidding for the perfect crime, Ed had bludgeoned his wife and put her into a car. The case came to light when two country policemen on patrol saw Mrs. Grammer's new big blue Chrysler, an anniversary present from her husband, speeding crazily down a hill just inside their jurisdiction. God bless our good cops. The car sideswiped a pole, ran up an embankment covered with beard grass, wild strawberry and cinquefoil, and overturned. The wheels were still gently spinning in the mellow sunlight when the officers removed Mrs. G's body. It appeared to be a routine highway accident at first. Alas, the woman's battered body did not match up with only minor damage suffered by the car. I did better. I rolled on. It was funny again to see the slender white church and the enormous elms. Forgetting that in an American suburban street, a lone pedestrian is more conspicuous than a lone motorist, I left the car in the avenue to walk unobtrusively past 342 Lawn Street. Before the great bloodshed, I was entitled to a little relief, to a cathartic spasm of mental regurgitation. Closed were the white shutters of the junk mansion, and somebody had attached a found black velvet hair ribbon to the white for sale sign which was leaning toward the sidewalk. No dog barked, no gardener telephoned, no Miss Opposite sat on the vined porch, where, to the lone pedestrian's annoyance, two ponytailed young women in identical polka-dotted pinafores stopped doing whatever they were doing to stare at him. She was long dead, no doubt. These might be her twin nieces from Philadelphia. Should I enter my old house? As in Turgenev's story, a torrent of Italian music came from an open window, that of the living room. What romantic soul was playing the piano where no piano had plunged and plashed on that bewitched Sunday with the sun on her beloved legs? All at once I noticed that from the lawn I had mown, a golden-skinned, brown-haired nymphette of 9 or 10 in white shorts was looking at me with wild fascination in her large blue-black eyes. I said something pleasant to her, meaning no harm, an old-world compliment, what nice eyes you have, but she retreated in haste, and the music stopped abruptly, and a violent-looking dark man, glistening with sweat, came out and glared at me. I was on the point of identifying myself when, with a pang of dream embarrassment, I became aware of my mud-caked dungarees, my filthy and torn sweater, my bristly chin, my bum's bloodshot eyes. Without saying a word, I turned and plodded back the way I had come. An aster-like anemic flower grew out of a remembered chink in the sidewalk. Quietly resurrected, Miss Opposite was being wheeled out by her nieces onto her porch, as if it were a stage, and I the star performer. Praying she would not call to me, I hurried to my car. What a steep little street! What a profound avenue! A red ticket showed between wiper and windshield. I carefully tore it into 2, 4, 8 pieces. Feeling I was losing my time, I drove energetically to the downtown hotel where I had arrived with a new bag more than 5 years before. I took a room, made 2 appointments by telephone, shaved, bathed, put on black clothes, and went down for a drink in the bar. Nothing had changed. The barroom was suffused with the same dim, impossible garnet red light that in Europe years ago went with low haunts, but here meant a bit of atmosphere in a family hotel. I sat at the same little table where at the very start of my stay, immediately after becoming Charlotte's lodger, I had thought fit to celebrate the occasion by suavely sharing with her a half bottle of champagne, which had fatally conquered her poor, brimming heart. As then, a moon-faced waiter was arranging with stellar care 50 sherries on a round tray for a wedding party. Murphy Fantasia, this time. It was 3:08. As I walked through the lobby, I had to skirt a group of ladies who, with mille grâces, were taking leave of each other after a luncheon party. With a harsh cry of recognition, one pounced upon me. She was a stout, short woman in pearl grey with a long grey slim plume to her small hat. It was Mrs. Chatfield. She attacked me with a fake smile all aglow with evil curiosity. Had I done to Dolly perhaps what Frank LaSalle, a 50-year-old mechanic, had done to 11-year-old Sally Horner in 1948? Very soon I had that avid glee well under control. She thought I was in California. How was, with exquisite pleasure, I informed her that my stepdaughter had just married a brilliant young mining engineer with a hush-hush job in the Northwest. She said she disapproved of such early marriages. She would never let her Phyllis, who was now 18. "Oh, yes, of course," I said quietly. "I remember Phyllis. Phyllis and Camp Q. Yes, of course. By the way, did she ever tell you how Charlie Holmes debauched there his mother's little charges?" Mrs. Chatfield's already broken smile now disintegrated completely. "For shame," she cried. "For shame, Mr. Humbert. The poor boy has just been killed in Korea." I said, didn't she think viand deux, with the infinitive, expressed recent events so much more neatly than the English just, with the past? But I had to be trotting off, I said. There were only 2 blocks to Windmuller's office. He greeted me with a very slow, very enveloping, strong, searching grip. He thought I was in California. Had I not lived at one time at Beardsley? His daughter had just entered Beardsley College, and how was I gave all necessary information about Mrs. Schiller. We had a pleasant business conference. I walked out into the hot September sunshine, a contented pauper. Now that everything had been put out of the way, I could dedicate myself freely to the main object of my visit to Ramsdale. In the methodical manner on which I have always prided myself, I had been keeping Claire Quilty's face masked in my dark dungeon, where he was waiting for me to come with barber and priest. Réveillez-vous, Lacue, il est temps de mourir. I have no time right now to discuss the mnemonics of physiognomization. I am on my way to his uncle and walking fast, but let me jot down this. I had preserved in the alcohol of a clouded memory the toad of a face. In the course of a few glimpses, I had noticed its slight resemblance to a cheery and rather repulsive wine-dealer, a relative of mine in Switzerland.
with his dumbbells and stinking tricot and fat hairy arms and bald patch and pig-faced servant concubine, he was on the whole a harmless old rascal. Too harmless, in fact, to be confused with my prey. In the state of mind I now found myself, I had lost contact with Trapp's image. It had become completely engulfed by the face of Claire Quilty, as represented with artistic precision by an easeled photograph of him that stood on his uncle's desk. In Beardsley, at the hands of charming Dr. Molnar, I had undergone a rather serious dental operation, retaining only a few upper and lower front teeth. The substitutes were dependent on a system of plates with an inconspicuous wire affair running along my upper gums. The whole arrangement was a masterpiece of comfort, and my canines were in perfect health. However, to garnish my secret purpose with a plausible pretext, I told Dr. Quilty that in hope of alleviating facial neuralgia, I had decided to have all my teeth removed. What would a complete set of dentures cost? How long would the process take, assuming we fixed our first appointment for some time in November? Where was his famous nephew now? Would it be possible to have them all out in one dramatic session? A white-smocked, grey-haired man, with a crew-cut and the big flat cheeks of a politician, Dr. Quilty perched on the corner of his desk, one foot dreamily and seductively rocking as he launched on a glorious long-range plan. He would first provide me with provisional plates until the gum settled. Then he would make me a permanent set. He would like to have a look at that mouth of mine. He wore perforated pied shoes. He had not visited with the rascal since 1946, but supposed he could be found at his ancestral home, Grim Road, not far from Parkington. It was a noble dream. His foot rocked, his gaze was inspired. It would cost me around 600. He suggested he take measurements right away, and make the first set before starting operations. My mouth to him was a splendid cave full of priceless treasures, but I denied him entrance. "No," I said. "On second thoughts, I shall have it all done by Dr. Molnar. His price is higher, but he, of course, is a much better dentist than you." I do not know if any of my readers will ever have a chance to say that. It is a delicious dream feeling. Claire's uncle remained sitting on the desk, still looking dreamy, but his foot had stopped push-rocking the cradle of rosy anticipation. On the other hand, his nurse, a skeleton-thin, faded girl, with the tragic eyes of unsuccessful blondes, rushed after me so as to be able to slam the door in my wake. "Push the magazine into the butt. Press home until you hear or feel the magazine catch engage. Delightfully snug. Capacity, 8 cartridges. Full blued. Aching to be discharged." A gas station attendant in Parkington explained to me very clearly how to get to Grim Road. Wishing to be sure Quilty would be at home, I attempted to ring him up, but learned that his private telephone had recently been disconnected. Did that mean he was gone? I started to drive to Grim Road, 12 miles north of the town. By that time, night had eliminated most of the landscape, and as I followed the narrow, winding highway, a series of short posts, ghostly white, with reflectors, borrowed my own lights to indicate this or that curve. I could make out a dark valley on one side of the road and wooded slopes on the other, and in front of me, like derelict snowflakes, moths drifted out of the blackness into my probing aura. At the 12th mile, as foretold, a curiously hooded bridge sheathed me for a moment, and beyond it a whitewashed rock loomed on the right, and a few car lengths further, on the same side, I turned off the highway up gravelly Grim Road. For a couple of minutes all was dank, dark, dense forest, then Pava Manor. A wooden house with a turret arose in a circular clearing. Its windows glowed yellow and red, its drive was cluttered with half a dozen cars. I stopped in the shelter of the trees and abolished my lights to ponder the next move quietly. He would be surrounded by his henchmen and whores. I could not help seeing the inside of that festive and ramshackle castle in terms of troubled teens, a story in one of her magazines. Vague orgies, a sinister adult with pineal cigar, drugs, bodyguards.
At least he was there. I would return in the torpid morning. Gently I rolled back to town in that old faithful car of mine which was serenely, almost cheerfully working for me. My Lolita. There was still a 3-year-old bobby pin of hers in the depths of the glove compartment. There was still that stream of pale moths siphoned out of the night by my headlights. Dark barns still propped themselves up here and there by the roadside. People were still going to the movies. While searching for night lodgings, I passed a drive-in, in a Selenian glow, truly mystical in its contrast with the moonless and massive night, on a gigantic screen slanting away among the drowsy fields. A thin phantom raised a gun, both he and his arm reduced to tremulous dishwater by the oblique angle of that receding world, and the next moment a row of trees shut off the gesticulation. I left Insomnia Lodge next morning around 8 and spent some time in Parkington. Visions of bungling the execution kept obsessing me. Thinking that perhaps the cartridges in the automatic had gone stale during a week of inactivity, I removed them and inserted a fresh batch. Such a thorough oil bath did I give Chum that now I couldn't get rid of the stuff. I bandaged him up with a rag like a maimed limb and used another rag to wrap up a handful of spare bullets. A thunderstorm accompanied me most of the way back to Grim Road, but when I reached Pava Manor, the sun was visible again, burning like a man, and the birds screamed in the drenched and steaming trees. The elaborate and decrepit house seemed to stand in a kind of daze, reflecting, as it were, my own state, for I could not help realizing, as my feet touched the springy and insecure ground, that I had overdone the alcoholic stimulation business. A guardedly ironic silence answered my bell. The garage, however, was loaded with his car, a black convertible for the nonce. I tried the knocker. A ree nobody. With a petulant snarl, I pushed the front door, and, how nice, it swung open as in a medieval fairy tale. Having softly closed it behind me, I made my way across a spacious and very ugly hall, peered into an adjacent drawing room, noticed a number of used glasses growing out of the carpet, and decided that Master was still asleep in the master bedroom. So I trudged upstairs. My right hand clutched muffled Chum in my pocket. My left patted the sticky banisters. Of the 3 bedrooms I inspected, one had obviously been slept in that night. There was a library full of flowers. There was a rather bare room with ample and deep mirrors and a polar bearskin on the slippery floor. There were still other rooms. A happy thought struck me. If and when Master returned from his constitutional in the woods, or emerged from some secret lair, it might be wise for an unsteady gunman with a long job before him to prevent his playmate from locking himself up in a room. Consequently, for at least 5 minutes I went about lucidly insane, crazily calm, an enchanted and very tight hunter, turning whatever keys in whatever locks there were, and pocketing them with my free left hand. The house, being an old one, had more planned privacy than have modern glamour boxes, where the bathroom, the only lockable locus, has to be used for the furtive needs of planned parenthood. Speaking of bathrooms, I was about to visit a third one when Master came out of it, leaving a brief waterfall behind him. The corner of a passage did not quite conceal me. Grey-faced, baggy-eyed, fluffily dishevelled in a scanty, balding way, but still perfectly recognisable, he swept by me in a purple bathrobe, very like one I had. He either did not notice me, or else dismissed me as some familiar and innocuous hallucination, and showing me his hairy calves, he proceeded, sleepwalker-wise, downstairs. I pocketed my last key and followed him into the entrance hall. He had half opened his mouth and the front door to peer out through a sunny chink as one who thinks he has heard a half-hearted visitor ring and recede. Then, still ignoring the rain-coated phantasm that had stopped in mid-stairs, Master walked into a cosy boudoir across the hall from the drawing-room, through which, taking it easy, knowing he was safe, I now went away from him, and in a bar-adorned kitchen gingerly unwrapped dirty Chum, taking care not to leave any oily stains on the chrome. I think I got the wrong product. It was black and awfully messy. In my usual meticulous way, I transferred Naked Chum to a clean recess about me and made for the little boudoir. My step, as I say, was springy. Too springy, perhaps, for success, but my heart pounded with tiger joy as I crunched a cocktail glass underfoot. Master met me in the Oriental parlour. "Now who are you?" he asked in a high, hoarse voice, his hands thrust into his dressing-gown pockets, his eyes fixing a point to the northeast of my head. "Are you by any chance Brewster?" By now it was evident to everybody that he was in a fog and completely at my so-called mercy. I could enjoy myself. "That's right," I answered suavely. "Je suis Monsieur Brewster. Let us chat for a moment before we start."
He looked pleased. His smudgy moustache twitched. I removed my raincoat. I was wearing a black suit, black shirt, no tie. We sat down in two easy chairs.
"You know," he said, scratching loudly his fleshy and gritty grey cheek, and showing his small pearly teeth in a crooked grin, "you don't look like Jack Brewster.
I mean, the resemblance is not particularly striking.
Somebody told me he had a brother with the same telephone company." To have him trapped, after those years of repentance and rage, to look at the black hairs on the back of his pudgy hands, to wander with 100 eyes over his purple silks and hirsute chest, foreglimpsing the punctures and mess and music of pain, to know that this semi-animated, subhuman trickster who had sodomized my darling, oh, my darling, this was intolerable bliss. "No, I'm afraid I'm neither of the Brewsters." He cocked his head, looking more pleased than ever.
"Guess again, Punch."
"Ah," said Punch, "so you've not come to bother me about those long-distance calls."
"You do make them once in a while, don't you?"
"Excuse me?" I said I had said I thought he had said he had never...
"People," he said, "people in general. I'm not accusing you, Brewster. But you know it's absurd the way people invade this damned house without even knocking. They use the water, they use the kitchen, they use the telephone. Phil calls Philadelphia, Pat calls Patagonia. Well, I refuse to pay. You have a funny accent, Captain."
"Quilty," I said, "do you recall a little girl called Dolores Hayes? Dolly Hayes. Dolly called Dolores Collar.
Sure, she may have made those calls, sure, any place, Paradise, Washington, Hell Canyon, who cares?"
"I do, Quilty. You see, I am her father."
"Nonsense," he said, "you are not. You are some foreign literary agent. A Frenchman once translated my proud flesh as La Fierté de la Chair.
Absurd. She was my child, Quilty."
In the state he was in, he could not really be taken aback by anything, but his blustering manner was not quite convincing. A sort of wary inkling kindled his eyes into a semblance of life. They were immediately dulled again.
"I am very fond of children myself," he said, "and fathers are among my best friends."
He turned his head away, looking for something. He beat his pockets. He attempted to rise from his seat.
"Down," I said, apparently much louder than I intended. "You need not roar at me," he complained in his strange feminine manner. "I just wanted a smoke. I'm dying for a smoke."
"You're dying, anyway."
"Oh, shucks," he said. "You begin to bore me. What do you want? Are you French, mister? Woolly wooboar? Let's go to the barumet and have a stiff."
He saw the little dark weapon lying in my palm, as if I were offering it to him.
"Say," he drawled, now imitating the underworld numbskull of movies, "that's a swell little gun you've got there. What do you want for her?"
I slapped down his outstretched hand, and he managed to knock over a box on the low table near him. It ejected a handful of cigarettes.
"Here they are," he said cheerfully. "You recall Kipling? Un femme et un femme et un caporel et un cigarette. Now we need matches."
"Quilty," I said, "I want you to concentrate. You are going to die in a moment. The hereafter, for all we know, may be an eternal state of excruciating insanity. You smoked your last cigarette yesterday. Concentrate. Try to understand what is happening to you.
He kept taking the drone cigarette apart and munching bits of it.
I'm willing to try, he said. You are either Australian or a German refugee. Must you talk to me? This is a Gentile's house, you know.